Hi there, welcome to Scandalous. This is a podcast about the most scandalous people and events in history. I'm your anonymous host, Em, and each episode I'll be bringing you stories of the disgraceful, heinous, outrageous, scurrilous, shameful, shocking, and slanderous. I know it's been a while, and I promised you guys this episode a while ago, and we're finally getting to it. Our second episode on the Black Queen, Catherine de Medici. Her long life was filled with scandal from beginning to end, including the event she was most notoriously involved in, the infamous St. Bartholomew Day's Massacre. Though she was a contemporary of Elizabeth I of England and also fought for religious tolerance, Catherine is remembered in history as the Black Queen, while Elizabeth is often touted as the glorious Virgin Queen who ushered in a golden era. And you'll find out why that is in this episode. Catherine de Medici was born in 1519 and lived during the height of the European Renaissance. Though usually thought of as an Italian, Catherine was actually half French. Her mother was the French princess Anne de la Tour d'Auvigny. Her father was Lorenzo II, a son of the Medici. The Medicis were one of the wealthiest and most powerful families in Europe, but they were not of noble blood. They were part of a new, rapidly rising merchant class, having made their riches by inventing the first international banking system. By the time Catherine was born, the family ruled the city of Florence, and her uncle had even been elected Pope of the Roman Catholic Church. The marriage of Catherine's parents had been a dazzling victory for the Medicis, as it signified the first royal blood to be tied to their family. Catherine's mother was a distant relative of the French king. According to a contemporary chronicler, when Catherine was born, her parents were, and I quote, as pleased as if it had been a boy. Even though she was a girl, as this glorious couple's first child, Catherine de Medici was born one of the wealthiest heiresses in Europe. Unfortunately, both of Catherine's young parents died from plague only a month after she was born, leaving her their sole heir. Catherine's life began with tragedy, and it seemed to follow her. After being passed around to different Medici relatives, she eventually found a home with her aunt, Clarice de Medici, who raised and educated the young girl. The next tragic blow came when Catherine was only 8 years old. The Medici family fell very hard and suddenly from power. See, Italian politics were never what one would call stable. The status of many political families rose and fell often, like waves on a stormy sea. Italy at this time wasn't a united nation, but a diverse geographical and cultural region made up of several city-states, such as Florence, Venice, Milan, etc. Each of these cities had a different ruling family, cultures, and even different languages. They were loosely tied together by geography and the overarching authority of the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church in Rome, but each territory was constantly at war with the others, and the ruling families often fell from power during their Game of Thrones. The Borgias are an excellent example of these types of warrior political families that ruled Italy at the time. I'm sure at least one of them will be getting an episode on this podcast. A little fun, scandalous side fact, the American-Italian mafia, known as the Cosa Nostra, or just the family, inherited their internal structure and much of their political culture from the infamous warrior families of their homeland. Having been born and raised as the most wealthy and spoiled noblewomen in Italy, Catherine now found her very life in danger. She was captured by the new ruling family of Florence and forced to live in a convent for her own protection. At different points during these early struggles, it was suggested by various enemies of her, among other solutions, that she be left in an army brothel to have her marriage prospects spoiled, or that she should be lowered over the city wall so that her allies would shoot and kill her by mistake. The intelligent young girl realized early in these years of captivity that to survive and flourish, she must ingratiate herself to those who held power over her. Catherine put on a brilliant mask of obedience and docility and charmed the nuns at the convent she was held captive in. The nuns were mostly second or third daughters of noble families who did not have large enough dowries to marry well. It helped that they respected Catherine as a fellow lady of their same esteemed social class. They gave Catherine her own room and spoiled her as much as they could. I can imagine Catherine probably learned much from these wise older noble women about how to conduct herself in the future as a powerful lady in Italian society. Though Catherine's captivity was somewhat comfortable, fate always seemed ready to step into her life and cause some mischief or scandal. A couple of years into her confinement, an armed guard came to escort Catherine away from her convent. Not knowing why they came for her or where she was going, and in fear for her life, the quick-witted 11-year-old girl cut off all of her hair and donned a habit in an attempt to convince the guards that she had become a nun. As they attempted to take her, she cried out to the guards, "Let us now see what excommunicated wretch will dare to drag a spouse of Christ from her monastery." It was a brilliant play, but despite her valiant effort, the guards did eventually take her. The people of Florence followed her armed escort through the streets, shouting all kinds of insults and death threats at her. The Medicis were powerful, but they weren't exactly loved by everyone. Despite this adversity, Catherine ultimately managed to use her magnificent personality to charm the captain of the guard, and she survived the journey to her new place of captivity. She was very good at surviving, and that talent would serve her very well in the future. I mentioned that Italian politics were unstable, right? By her early years, the political tides had turned again in Italy, and once again, the Medicis ruled Florence, and Rome had a Medici pope. Catherine's aunt had sadly passed during her confinement, so this new pope, Catherine's cousin, was now her sole guardian. And this pope was extremely excited about Catherine's future marriage prospects, and how she could be used as a pawn in the game of international politics. As she was now of marriageable age, which was around 13 or 14 in this era, Catherine was now considered as a bride for the most eligible bachelor princes of Europe, including, interestingly, Henry VIII's illegitimate son, the Duke of Richmond. But the Medici Pope was an ambitious man. He knew Catherine's worth and wanted the best for her, not a mere nobleman or a bastard son of a king. After some absolutely Medician scheming, he was able to secure a treaty with Francis I of France, which included the marriage of Catherine to Francis's second son, Henri. This marriage would put Catherine and any of her children in line to the throne of France. It was an absolute triumph for the Medici family. And so, at just 14, with much pomp and ceremony, Catherine was shipped off to a foreign country to marry a man she had never met. She was sent by her cousin Pope with a giant dowry and endless jewels and dresses, etc. Catherine was absolutely covered in jewels as she entered the city by carriage. Onlookers wondered how the young girl would be able to walk under such weight, but Catherine managed. She always managed. On the plus side, she would be marrying a prince who was second in line to the throne of France, and she would become a royal princess. And at least her future husband was her same age. She could very well have been married off to a much older man, as was often done, and she would eventually force her own daughter to do. As Catherine discovered upon meeting her husband, Henry was athletic and very attractive. It did not take long for this princess, who had been through such tragedy and suffered such loss, to fall completely in love with her new prince. Unfortunately, Catherine's story is not a fairy tale with a happily ever after. I did warn you that tragedy haunted her throughout her life. Though Catherine had her lovely French prince, Henri was not as enthusiastic about his princess. To put it bluntly, Catherine de' Medici was not considered beautiful. Her mouth was too large, and she had the bulging eyes which were common to the Medici clan. Though charming and elegant and attractive in her own way, Catherine was not up to the beauty standards of French society, which prized nothing above physical beauty. A diplomat described her later in life as, and I quote, "a beautiful woman when her face is veiled." This wasn't all Catherine had going against her in Henri's eyes. Though she was rich and half French, Catherine was considered a foreigner from a much reviled enemy territory. The French also considered the purity of her noble French blood to have been corrupted by the merchant Medicis. This was incredibly unfortunate for Catherine, as the French were about as obsessed with rank and lineage as they were with physical beauty. Catherine's cousin had married her off to a people who were predisposed to dislike her. Henri, as it turns out, was not thrilled to be married off to a woman he considered unattractive and beneath him. I'm just gonna say it now and get it out of the way. Henri was kind of a dick. But he had a reason to be. Just like Catherine, Henri had a turbulent childhood, to say the least. His father, Francis I, had been captured in a battle with Spain. He traded his two eldest sons, who were only young boys at the time, as hostages in return for his freedom. Francis had no intention of honoring the original terms of the agreement, and it took years to finally negotiate the boys' release. They were left by their father to rot in solitary confinement in a Spanish dungeon. By the time they were returned to France, the one happy and charming Henri had turned into a sullen and cranky young man. But can you blame him? The boys had even forgotten how to speak French. The king had no patience for this kind of emo melodrama from a royal prince, and he openly favored Henri's brother. Though Henri was his second son, this marriage and the alliance with Rome was incredibly important to the king. So important, in fact, that Francis refused to leave the bedchamber the night of the marriage, so he could personally witness the bedding. Yes, the teenage Catherine lost her virginity while her new father-in-law, the King of France, watched. Francis, pleased with what he saw, reportedly said later that each had shown valor in the joust. Though the wedding night went well, Catherine found quickly, to her great consternation, that Henri was already in love with another woman. He was wholly devoted to a lady almost 20 years his senior, the fabulous Diane de Poitiers. And Diane had no intention of giving him up. Though much older than Henri, Diane was in her prime, tall, elegant, cold, and beautiful. Short, dark, bulgy-eyed Catherine was no match against this lovely siren. Henri courted Diane publicly and wore her colors at jousts, which humiliated Catherine. The prince spent the majority of his time with Diane instead of his new wife, whom he showed little interest in. To make matters worse, only a few months into her life in France, Catherine's cousin, the Pope, died, leaving her dowry unpaid and the papal alliance with France broken. Without her inheritance and the alliance to protect her, Catherine was now politically useless. Francis proclaimed grumpily that Catherine had come to his court stark naked. She could have been repudiated and sent back to Italy or put into another convent, but Catherine did everything she could to avoid this fate. Just as she had done before in a situation of powerlessness, she hid her shame and anger and worked at charming the French court and the most powerful man there, her new father-in-law, the king. Francis I was a true Renaissance prince, handsome, cultured, and highly intelligent. He was obsessed with beauty and art and was absolutely dazzled by the works of the Italian Renaissance. Catherine used this to her advantage. She spoke to the king in Italian and intrigued him with stories of her childhood growing up in the papal court, which was filled with opulence, beauty, and the artists France so adored. The king suddenly became very interested in this young, quiet girl he had barely noticed before. Catherine used all of the weapons in her charming arsenal to bewitch the king, and he delighted in her wit and charm. He admired this young woman who, though not beautiful, was incredibly intelligent and amusing, especially for her age. He even began to call Catherine my daughter. Francis I was dominated by his powerful mistress, the Duchesse of Anton. Seeing how much he enjoyed Catherine's company, she took the young girl up as well, allowing her to become part of the ultra-exclusive set of fashionable women she headed. This flock of lovely beauties, known as La Petite Bande, constantly surrounded and entertained the king. Catherine's entrance into this little group signaled to the court that she now had the king's protection and favor. Though Catherine regained some of her dwindling status with this brilliant coup, her husband was not so pleased with her. Catherine had yet to give him a child, and Henri's favorite, Diane, was rivals with the king's mistress. any enemy of Dion's was an enemy of Henri's, and he did not appreciate his wife being so friendly with an enemy. Catherine was caught between the two rival powers, a position she would become stuck in repeatedly for the rest of her life. Catherine's inability to conceive became a real problem for her when Henri's elder brother died suddenly, leaving Henri and Catherine as the new heirs to the French throne. This meant that Catherine would someday be queen and would be responsible for birthing the next king of France. All eyes fell on her expectantly. As Francis and Henri mourned their son and brother, Catherine did everything in her power to conceive, but nothing she did seemed to work. Finally, convinced she was doing something wrong, Catherine reportedly decided to spy on Henri and his mistress to see what they did in bed. She had a small hole cut in her floorboard so she could peer downstairs into the bedroom occupied by her husband and his lover. She didn't see much, as their lovemaking brought her to tears of jealousy, but she saw enough to know that it was nothing she was doing wrong. Henri subsequently impregnated one of his mistresses and publicly acknowledged the child, which humiliated Catherine only further. Henri's friends soon began to suggest to him that perhaps he should rid himself of his barren, poor, useless Italian wife. Catherine, now in perilous danger of losing her position, fell on the mercy of the king, quite literally. She knew Francis loved her and would not be able to repudiate her in person. In tears, she went on her knees before Francis, telling him that she understood that the marriage must be annulled. She begged only that she would be allowed to remain in France to serve whichever great lady would replace her, instead of being sent to a convent. Francis, who was never able to stand to see a woman cry, which Catherine knew, was defeated. He said to her, "My child, it is God's will that you should be my daughter and the wife of the Dauphin. So be it." Catherine's place as Henry's wife had been saved, but her position was still precarious. Help came to Catherine, finally, from a strange source. Henri's favorite, Dion. Dion did not want the docile Catherine to be replaced by a more beautiful or ambitious lady who may become a rival for Henri's affections. So she took Catherine under her wing and did all she could to help. Catherine allowed this to happen, pretending to be grateful and to like Dion. Dion went so far as arousing Henry and then sending him to Catherine's bed to finish the act with her. She also gave Catherine some sexual advice. Apparently, Henri had a medical condition which caused his penis to point downward when erect. Dion suggested to Catherine that they might try a different sexual position, which, translated into English, meant something like in the style of a dog. This was not the only time Dion and Catherine worked together. Years later, Henri would eventually fall for a new, younger mistress who was a rival to Dion and an annoyance to Catherine. The two ladies double-teamed Henri and basically made the man's life a living hell until he finally sent the new mistress away. It took a few years, but after receiving regular nightly visits from her husband, Catherine finally became pregnant. Side note, apparently it was known amongst the nobility that Medici women had a family trait of not being as fertile in their early youths. Francis's sister, who was one of the few people at court who was very kind to Catherine, attempted to comfort her with this fact when she was still having trouble getting pregnant. Catherine gave birth to a boy, to her delight and the general ecstasy of all France. Suddenly, this much-despised Italian princess had become the mother of the future king of France. This changed everything for Catherine and her future destiny. She had finally fulfilled her purpose as a royal princess, and Francis I showered her with honors and gifts. The child was named Francis after his glorious grandfather, which pleased the king greatly. Though her position was now heightened and secured, the birth of a son had not done much to alter Henri's love for his favorite, Dion. Once Henri had become heir to the throne, Dion had finally allowed Henri to become her lover. Henceforth, Henri dressed only in Dion's colors and created a monogram with their initials entwined, which he plastered on every surface imaginable. Catherine found, to her great displeasure, that Dion wouldn't only usurp her role as wife, but also as mother. Dion had experience raising the children she'd had with her late husband, so Henri put her in charge of the royal nursery. Dion would be the one responsible for raising all of Catherine's children, and would make every decision about their welfare. Catherine had very little to do with any of her children's upbringing. She rarely saw them, which may be why she never seemed to have formed an intimate, motherly bond with any of them. Catherine had secured her place at the French court just in time. In 1547, her only protector in France, Francis I, died at the age of 52. This left 28-year-old Henri and Catherine as the new rulers. Catherine, an overlooked, scorned, merchant-blooded Italian, through some trick of fate, had become the new Queen of France. As with every happiness in her life, though, this success was also tinged with tragedy. Catherine was queen, but only in name. Henri let all of France know quite publicly that he considered Diane to be his true consort. He elevated Diane to the rank of duchess and showered her with gifts, including the first pick of the royal jewels. Henri also gave Diane the most coveted chateau in the kingdom instead of giving it to his wife, whom Francis had promised it to. If someone sent a gift to Catherine, they knew they must also offer something even more lovely to Diane. The Pope even gave Diane a gorgeous necklace of pearls. She was given the legal right to sell high offices and to keep the revenues from these sales, which made her a rich and very powerful woman. Catherine didn't even get to choose her eldest son's fiancé. Diane had brokered a deal in which the young prince would marry into the powerful Guise family, whom Diane was allied with. They were so close, in fact, that the young Guise children were brought up with the royal children. The Guise clan was headed by two ambitious brothers, François, the Duke of Guise, and Claude, who would soon become the Cardinal of Lorraine. Catherine hated the Guises, who had been part of the group lobbying Henry to annul his marriage with her. They proposed one of their own daughters as a replacement for Catherine. The Guises successfully engaged Catherine's son to their niece, the beautiful Mary Stuart, Queen of Scots. Mary arrived at the French court in 1547 when she was only 5 years old and grew up with the royal children. As she grew older, she followed the rest of the court in openly disrespecting Catherine, reportedly saying that her mother-in-law was the daughter of merchants. She also made fun of the queen's Italian accent. Catherine bore all of this graciously, as she did every other slight, but she never forgot it. Mary eventually married Francis in 1558, to the delight of all France. After 2 decades of being sidelined by her husband, Catherine may have felt that her status as an overlooked and disregarded queen would last the rest of her life, but this was not to be the case. In 1559, only a year after their first son's marriage, Henri decided to hold a joust to celebrate a new treaty he had signed. Catherine reportedly had terrible dreams the night before the joust in which she saw her husband covered in blood. Despite Catherine's desperate pleas with Henri not to ride that day, her 40-year-old husband jousted 3 times. On the 3rd round, the king forgot to put his helmet on and took a lance to the eye. More like, in the eye. It was not a pretty sight, pardon the pun. Catherine had reportedly summoned the infamous diviner Nostradamus to court in 1556 after reading his latest published predictions, particularly the one which read, "The young lion will overcome the older one on the field of combat in a single battle. He will pierce his eyes through a golden cage, 2 wounds made one, then he dies a cruel death." Catherine's association with Nostradamus, her purported visions, and her dabbling in the occult are partially to blame for her subsequent reputation as the Black Queen. Though he survived the initial injury, the king's wound became infected, and only 10 days after the infamous joust, Henri II was dead. The king is dead. Long live the king. Catherine completely broke down, being apparently inconsolable over her husband's death. Despite how badly Henri had treated her, Catherine had always loved him. His death broke her heart, and she would only wear black for the rest of her life as a sign of her endless mourning for him. Though nearly prostrate with grief, Catherine did find it within herself to decree that Diane was banished from court. Only 1 day after the king's death, Catherine requested the royal jewels back from her husband's former mistress. They were returned with a full written inventory and a written apology from Diane. Catherine also took possession of the chateau Henri had given Diane. After having pretended to like her husband's mistress for over 20 years, Catherine now kicked the woman to the curb and never saw her again. She later said to one of her daughters, "If I made good cheer for Madame Diane, it was the king that I was really entertaining. And besides, I always let him know that I was against my will, for never did a woman who loved her husband succeed in loving his whore. For one cannot call her otherwise, though the word is a horrid one to us." Diane did not fare much better with her allies, the Guises. They dropped her from favor as quickly as Catherine had. The Duke of Guise immediately moved into Diane's new empty suite of grand apartments. Charles, the younger of the Guise brothers, who had received his cardinal's robes thanks to Diane's influence and favor, now let her know that he believed his family had demeaned itself by its connection with her. I'd say the Guises were snakes, but even snakes have more loyalty than the Guises did. Catherine's daughter-in-law, Mary, the Queen of Scots, was now the Queen of France. She kept to Catherine's side and helped guide her through the grief-stricken days following her husband's passing. She sat with Catherine while receiving guests who were giving their condolences. She spoke for the Queen Mother when Catherine did not have the strength. The Guises were now at the height of their political power. Though Catherine's son, Francis, was now king, he was not yet quite old enough to rule on his own and command the sort of authority required by a monarch. Via a brilliant coup, the Guises secured power over the young prince and of the country. Legally, the right to rule as regent should have fallen to the senior noblemen in France after the royal princes, which was Antoine Bourbon. Fortunately for the Guises, Antoine was a lazy, submissive man who was easily outmaneuvered. The Guises claimed superior entitlement to rule on the basis of their familial connection with the young new queen, and would therefore serve as regents. The brothers would split the responsibility of ruling the country in two, and they would rule together equally. Catherine, still stunned by her loss, watched as her most hated rivals took possession of her son and the country. She could have attempted to intervene, but she let it happen because she was betting that they would not last long in power. France had many financial and political problems at this time that Catherine knew could only be solved through the sort of cutbacks and harsh governing that would ultimately make the Guises hated by the people. Their bid for ultimate power would hopefully be their downfall. So, to understand the rest of the story, I have to give you a mini-history of the Protestant Reformation and the Wars of Religion. In the 16th century, a religious reform movement known as Protestantism began to sweep across Catholic Europe. Reformers became known as Protestants because they were protesting aspects of the Catholic Church. There were several different kinds of Protestants. French reformers were generally Calvinists, who followed the teachings of John Calvin. Each reformer sect had its own diverging beliefs, but all were seeking reform of the Roman Catholic Church, which they accused of having become too worldly and distant from the common people. By this time period, many powerful European kingdoms had officially converted to Protestantism, including England and the German territories. Protestants wanted the freedom to read the Bible in the common tongue instead of Latin, so they could interpret it for themselves. Previously, only clergymen and nobility who had been educated in Latin could read the Bible or understand anything said during the Mass. The reformers also believed that each person could speak to God directly without the need of an intermediary, such as a priest. Most of the sects also shunned the idea of worshiping saints and many other sacred Catholic practices, believing them to be a form of idolatry. Most importantly, they rejected the idea of Holy Communion. The belief that the bread and wine consumed during Mass, once consecrated, became the literal, physical embodiment of Jesus Christ. To modern people, these differences may seem like small details, but in the 1500s, ideas like these were considered absolutely heinous and blasphemous by most Catholics. Remember the Pilgrims? You know, Plymouth Rock, etc. They were Puritans, a niche Protestant sect that believed Calvinists weren't Protestant enough. Their goal was to purify Protestantism. The Puritans were considered dangerous religious fanatics and heretics by most of Europe, which was why they ultimately made the decision to flee to the Americas and start a new society there. For centuries, French had been ardently Catholic, and for good reason. It shared a border with the two most Catholic kingdoms in Europe, Italy and Spain. Were France to come under the sway of Protestantism, Italians, the Roman Catholic Church, and the mighty armies of Spain would happily invade France. They had attempted to invade England on the same premise in the same period. The Spanish king sent an entire armada of battleships in a failed attempt to invade England and oust the Protestant Queen Elizabeth I. Elizabeth and her ancestors had only been able to successfully convert the majority of her populace to Protestantism because there was such a distance between England and the hub of Catholic power. France acted as a sort of buffer zone between the two. Though the majority of France remained Catholic, by the 1550s, reformer ideas had become popular among some of the populace of France, including the nobility. Having gained control of the country, the Guises found it nearly bankrupt, so they enacted severe austerity measures in an attempt to gain income, just as Catherine had predicted. This did not exactly ingratiate them with the people of France. Their habit of burning religious reformers did nothing to enhance their reputations. Protestant religious reformers were in open rebellion against the Guises, whom they accused of taking power of the country illegally. Technically, they were right. Antoine de Bourbon's wife, Jeanne d'Albret, was the leader of the reformer community in France, and so the reformers obviously supported Antoine's claim to power over the Guises. In 1560, some of the French reformers, under the leadership of Antoine de Bourbon's younger brother, made a disorganized attempt at a coup. The plan was to kidnap the king and arrest the Guise brothers. This failed plot, which had been secretly financed by Elizabeth I of England, would come to be known as the Conspiracy of Amboise. It may be where the French reformers got the nickname they subsequently went by. Supposedly, when the reformers fled from the Catholics, some witnesses said the reformers looked like poor men, not worth an huguenot. An huguenot was a small amount of French money, similar to a dollar bill. The reformers, many of whom believed in the holiness of poverty and modesty, reclaimed the name and took it on as their sobriquet. The Guises' revenge on the Huguenot conspirators was ruthless. Dozens of men were hanged or sewn into sacks and thrown into the river to drown. 52 of the leading conspirators were sentenced to execution, and all of them were beheaded in a gruesome spectacle that was witnessed by the entire French court. The Huguenots, enraged by such violent repression, only became more rebellious and determined. They began arming themselves and preparing for what they felt would inevitably become a holy war. At this point, some very important, powerful noblemen began to defect to the Huguenots. Whether this was due to genuine religious conversion or because they hated the Guises that much was yet to be seen. Catherine was terrified for herself and her children. She was stuck between two powerful rivals who were fighting for the control of her son and the country she had sworn to protect. Should either side prevail, Catherine may be pushed to the side, or her son's claim to the throne somehow negated. She couldn't let either side win. This was one Gaspard de Coligny, admiral of France, and the leader of France's navy, in an attempt to gain allies, helpfully suggested to Catherine that perhaps she should be the one ruling the country. Catherine apparently secretly agreed with him. After doing some research, Catherine found that the majority of Huguenots were not rebels or traitors against her own son or the crown. They only wanted the Guises out of power, much like herself. It made more political sense for Catherine to support the Huguenots, who were respectful to her, unlike the greedy, disloyal Guises. And so she listened when the Huguenot royal chancellor, Michel de l'Hôpital, convinced Catherine that the best course of action was to make peace between the two belief systems via a meeting of a general council, which would discuss and mediate the religious dispute. Catherine used all of her guile to innocently suggest and then convince the Guises to agree to the idea. A preliminary assembly was scheduled, which would formally introduce the idea of calling a national conclave to discuss the religious tensions. During the assembly, everyone officially agreed to attend the conclave. Both sides also agreed that until the conclave happened, there would be peace. Any rebellion or violence inflicted by either side would be considered treason against the king. Catherine breathed a sigh of relief and felt proud of her success in her first attempt at a political negotiation. She should have known, perhaps, that the Guises were up to something. They never gave up easily, nor gave an inch unless they saw a reason to. Catherine was blinded by her pride. She never saw the trap the Guises had laid. See, the Guises knew something Catherine and the Huguenots did not. Their spies had found out about another conspiratorial plot by the Huguenots that was currently underway. Unlike the Amboise conspiracy, this time they had actual evidence that Antoine and his brother were the leaders of the rebellion. And so, once the conclave met, the Guises dropped their bombshell evidence. Since both sides had agreed that any type of rebellion against the crown was illegal, Antoine and the Prince of Condé were summoned to court to answer to the charges. Condé, fearful of an invasion by a Guise army, lest he not show up, answered the summons. Upon his arrival at the royal court, he was arrested and imprisoned. The Guises, in a rush to see Condé convicted, had him tried by a private tribunal, which conveniently sentenced him to death for treason. Antoine had made what was apparently the only smart decision in his life and refused to appear at court. Just as the two sides were at the height of their tensions, fate and tragedy stepped into Catherine's life once again. The young King Francis had been plagued by an undiagnosed illness since his birth, probably genetic tuberculosis inherited from Catherine. He had an earache, which turned into a large abscess. It's still uncertain what exact ailment Francis suffered from, but whatever it was, it killed the poor king when he was only 16 years old. And so the tides of power in France shifted once again. I mentioned previously that though Catherine loved them, she had not grown close with her children as they grew up. This is perhaps why her child's death didn't seem to affect Catherine the way the death of her husband had. She was working on a plot to gain control of the country before Francis had even died. Her focus was now on her second son and protecting his right to the crown. Francis had been so weak and physically undeveloped that even by his death, his testicles had never dropped. He hadn't sired any royal heirs, so upon Francis's death, Catherine's next son became the heir. This meant that Francis's grieving widow, Mary Stuart, the Queen of Scots, was no longer the Queen of France. Catherine didn't even give the shocked girl a full day of mourning before asking for the royal jewels back. As soon as her official period of mourning was over, Catherine made it clear to her former daughter-in-law that Mary no longer had a place at the French royal court. She was asked to retire to one of her Guise uncle's estates. The Guises wanted Mary to wed Catherine's second son, Charles, the new heir to the throne, so she could continue to be queen. I can only imagine the pleasure Catherine must have taken in denying them this prize. The Guises also tried to marry their widowed niece to the King of Spain's son. Unfortunately for young Mary, Catherine had married her own eldest daughter to the Spanish king a few years earlier. Catherine now used her influence with her daughter, who had become the Queen of Spain, to secretly dissuade the king from the match. Mary Stuart, having had every potential European marriage prospect blocked by Catherine, was finally sent back to Scotland. Mary had taken Catherine's pretense of docility and friendliness at face value, and she had completely misjudged and underestimated Catherine, as most people had. But Catherine never forgot a slight nor forgave it. Mary never was to know that Catherine, working behind the scenes, had been the cause of this final misfortune. Catherine's second son, Charles, was now the new King of France. He was only 10 years old, which meant he was far too young to rule on his own. A regency was inevitable. Catherine took Admiral Coligny's helpful advice and plotted to make herself regent. The Guises, after all, had no legitimate claim to power, as their niece was no longer queen. Suddenly, the Guise brothers began to rethink their decision to condemn the Condés, who were princes of the blood, after all, to death. Antoine de Bourbon was now, beyond any doubt, the man who should have been acting as regent for the young king. As Francis lay dying, Catherine summoned Antoine to court for a private meeting. She invited the Guises to join her as well in an advisory role. Instead of offering Antoine the regency, she surprised everyone in attendance by offering him a deal instead. If he gave up his right to the regency to Catherine, she would release his brother and make Antoine the lieutenant general of the kingdom. She also promised to marry her youngest daughter to Antoine's son, which would put his family more directly in line to the royal throne. Antoine was a weak-willed man, as I've mentioned, who wanted nothing more than to get as far away from the royal court as he could. He readily agreed with Catherine's proposition. Now, Catherine turned to the Guises, who were absolutely stunned by her bold move. She knew the precarious situation they were in regarding the arrest of Condé, so she offered them a way out, implying coyly that she would pretend Francis had ordered the arrests instead of the Guises. If the king died, nobody would know the truth, and the entire mess could be laid at his feet instead of theirs. The Guises, outmaneuvered by the formerly docile queen they had overlooked, knew they had no choice but to agree to Catherine's regency. And that was how an Italian with merchant blood became, essentially, the absolute ruler of France. Catherine was now the most powerful woman in Europe, even eclipsing the magnificent Elizabeth I. And we'll learn all about her infamous reign in the next episode. Thank you so much for listening. As always, if you have any questions or comments, you can always reach out on social media. Just look up Scandalous History Podcast on any of the platforms. We are there. We also have an Instagram and Pinterest account with extra historical images relating to each episode. Thanks for listening, and see you next time on Scandalous.